This is the Roscoe's Wetsuit Neuro Podcast, the neurohacking show where we teach you how to optimize your cognition. Keep up to date at roscoeswetsuitneuro.com. Now here's your host, Toby Passman.
All right, we have a special guest on the show with us today, April Davila. April is an author and mindfulness instructor. Publishers Weekly called her novel, 142 Ostriches, a vivid, uplifting debut. And Writer's Digest listed her website as one of the best 101 websites for writers. After studying mindfulness with Tara Brock and Jack Kornfield, she was certified as a mindfulness meditation teacher by the Greater Good Science Center at the University of California at Berkeley. She's the co-founder of A Very Important Meeting, an online platform hosting over a dozen mindful writing groups every week. So April, super excited to have you on the show with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what was kind of your introduction to mindfulness? Where did you first hear about it and how did you originally get into it?
That's such a good question. I mean, I grew up in Northern California where a lot of mindfulness kind of bloomed in the late 70s or maybe even late 60s, I guess it was. So I was always kind of aware of it, but my first personal experience was at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California, where Jack Kornfield teaches. And I actually signed up for a day-long meditation just out of curiosity. Jack Kornfield was teaching it. I didn't know who he was at the time. I had no idea that he would become this lifelong teacher that I've studied with, and had just the most wonderful experience. It was one of, I think a lot of people have that experience where you, maybe you dabble a little bit or you go for the first time and you're like, this, I feel great. I'm so relaxed. Everything's wonderful. And then you go home and you start practicing on your own. You're like, I'm not feeling wonderful. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Like, why can't I reproduce how I was feeling on that magical day? And I definitely fell into that trap. I got frustrated with it. I didn't really, I felt like I was doing it wrong. And as a consequence, I would just practice periodically. I was not very dedicated in the practice. I didn't have the desire to be. And it wasn't until 2016. I mean, I dabbled off and on. There were periods where I was more dedicated to the practice than not. But it was 2016 when I actually just hit a wall in my life. I was very unhappy. I was drinking too much. I guess midlife crisis, classic stuff, didn't know what I was doing with myself. And I signed up for a class called The Meaningful Life that was being taught in Los Angeles near my home in Silver Lake. We were living there at the time. And it was, I think it was exactly what I needed. It was very intensive. You called into a meditation every morning. It was a 25-minute meditation. And then every other week we met as a group. And it kind of blew my mind. Like it really, I became aware of the patterns of my brain in a way that I hadn't been before when I was just dabbling in practice. And I really didn't like a lot of the things that I found. And that was really upsetting, like deeply upsetting in a lot of ways. And I feel like ever since then, I've been kind of just chewing on that. Because when you can see things that you don't like, then you can start to make choices around them. And so I feel like the choices I've been making in my life since 2016 have been in response to the fact of, I guess, in response to becoming more aware of my own mental patterns and saying like, I don't like this and making changes.
What were some of those patterns that you found to be particularly problematic that you hadn't previously been aware of?
I mean, drinking was a big one. I never drank. I didn't binge drink. I mean, like in college, maybe, but like by 2016, I was a mother of two. I wasn't like out partying every night, but I would drink a glass of wine every night that would turn into two or three and sometimes four. I was working, and then because I was working full time, the only time I had to work on my novel was to get up early before work and work on the novel. And when you've had a bottle of wine to yourself the night before, it's very hard to get up in the morning and do something, even if it's what you really want to do. And I just saw that I was setting myself up for all of these frustrations. Like, I was setting myself up to be hungover every morning, setting myself up to not be able to work, like not have a clear head and work on my novel for the only time period I had to work on my novel. And that would just depress me. And then I would feel like I'm not making any progress towards this thing that I love writing. And I so want to finish this book, but I kept self-sabotaging. So then I decided I didn't want to drink every night, but just deciding something like that doesn't make it suddenly easy. You know, what I started to realize when I stopped drinking is I had to deal with all the reasons that I was drinking, which was just avoiding a lot of unhappy responses to things, the things I was frustrated with. I mean, even just like having a fight with my husband, which everyone does, or, you know, whoever you live with, from time to time, you're going to argue. And I would drink instead of talking about it or dealing with it. And so I had to start talking about it and dealing with it. I mean, it was a very tough transition in a lot of ways. And I don't feel like I'm completely done, I guess, hashing out all the things in my life, but I've done a lot of them in the last 6 years. So, yeah.
So mindfulness kind of made you more aware and maybe able to actually kind of tackle some of those problems and have some of those conversations that you otherwise kind of just resorted to drinking instead of dealing with?
Yeah, I would just get way too uncomfortable to deal with them. You know, if I was feeling disappointed about something, the idea of talking about it, the idea of like sitting down with my husband and just the overwhelming fear of confrontation or any kind of strife in the home, I just would immediately be like, everything's fine. I'm just going to have a glass of wine. Everything's fine. And recognizing that pattern and trying to unwind it was directly related to becoming more aware of it through my mindfulness practice.
If you're interested in learning to improve your cognition through the use of nutrition, supplementation, nootropics, exercise, and sleep, go ahead and check out roscoeswetsuitneuro.com. In neurohealth coaching, we review your current cognitive status and work with you to improve your cognition through the use of the latest research-backed neuroscientific tips and tools.
And then in terms of your writing, tell me kind of what you noticed when you started really getting serious about mindfulness. How did that impact your writing abilities?
Oh, so many ways. I actually have just finished putting together, I'm calling it the 6-week Mindful Writer Challenge. I just finished the first round with my first 10 students, and it's basically a 6-week course where I teach all the things that mindfulness taught me about writing and how to be a better writer. Because when I look back on my writing career, it was around 2016 that I started to get some traction and some successes, some publications. I found an agent, sold my first book. And at first I was like, well, meditation didn't do that. I was very skeptical. But when I really picked apart the things that I realized I got better at as a writer, they were related to mindfulness and my meditation practice. So things like quieting the inner critic so that you can get that first draft on the page. And then the diving into, say, mindfulness of emotion meditation so that you can be comfortable with an uncomfortable emotion long enough to get it on the page with the right words to describe it. I mean, that's an uncomfortable thing to do. And you have to be able to sit with anger, sit with heartache. Otherwise, your story is going to be very surface level. It's not going to have a lot of heart to it. And then when you get to the end of your first draft and you have to go back and start editing, then you want your inner critic. Then you have to like embrace that inner critic and be like, let's really tear this thing apart and see where it's not working and really see what's on the page versus what I imagined when I was writing it. I mean, all of these are things that I learned through meditation that have directly affected my writing.
So in terms of kind of silencing that inner critic, tell me about kind of the process there. Because I'm very familiar with that as a writer myself. Like, there's definitely, you know, unless I have a couple of drinks or maybe smoke a little bit of weed, you know, that really helps me just kind of get all of my thoughts out onto the page. Whereas writing sober, I've found it's that, like, I'm trying to perfect every little sentence, and then, you know, an hour's gone by and I have one page. So that inner critic is like so strong. So tell me, like, how exactly does mindfulness help you sort of manage that? Because I'm assuming it doesn't take the inner critic away.
No, never. No, I wish you could. But then also I don't wish, because you do need that inner critic when you set to editing. It's very useful. So you don't want to get rid of it. You just have to teach it to sit in the corner when you don't need it. And there's that old quote people like to throw out of Hemingway saying, like, oh, I write drunk and I edit sober. And for some people it works. It worked for Hemingway. My challenge with that is that if I'm writing drunk and then I'm like, okay, now I want to switch to edit mode, like, forget it, my mind is gone. Like, there is no edit mode when you've smoked a little bit or drunk some wine. So mindfulness can play the same role of getting the inner critic to sit down. The way I usually do it with my students is we'll do a very short mindfulness of thought meditation where you use an anchor. Often it's the breath, but it can also just be the sounds in the room, whatever anchor works for you. And you rest your attention on the anchor and you just notice when your mind wanders, right? So you're focusing on your breath and then you're like, oh, I'm planning dinner. Just noticing that, and then come back to the breath and like, oh, now I'm remembering that time that so-and-so, okay, back to the anchor. Just becoming aware of where your mind goes. That's the exercise. That's the whole thing. And then we end the meditation and we go immediately into our writing. And what I tell my students is to treat the writing like it's your meditation. So as you're writing, you hear the little voice say, like, well, that sucked. You better erase that. Okay, now I'm just going to keep writing and keep going. Like, duly noted, I'm just going to keep writing. And then that, as soon as you write the next sentence, that little voice pipes in again of like, God, why do you even bother? This is the worst. This is the worst sentence anyone has ever written. Delete that. Delete that right now before anyone sees it. Okay, thank you for your opinion. I'm just going to keep writing. And the more you practice that, the better you get at just noticing the thought and just letting it be a thought and come back to the writing and just keep writing. And when you can do that, what you end up with is a crappy first draft, which is exactly what you want. First drafts will be crappy. And I think you really have to embrace that. And, you know, there was some other writer who uses the, I don't know how, what your audience is, but she calls it her shitty first draft. And that is kind of become an industry term, the shitty first draft. You can bleep me. And then you go back and you edit. And I think the best advice I ever got as a writer is that you can't edit a blank page. Just get it on the page, and then you can turn a pile of poo into a masterpiece, but you can't edit a blank page. So quieting that inner critic long enough to get the words down and say, okay, I know it's crappy. I'm just going to keep writing. And then lo and behold, you've got a first draft. Then you can go back and be hard with yourself. Oh God, that sentence really was bad. Let's fix that. Oh, that's not really what I meant. I meant to say it more like this. And then, you know, it starts to get better and better and better. And then you end up with something you're proud of and you can put out in the world.
So an interesting phenomena that I've linked to writing just in my own life has been flow states. You know, Stephen Kotler wrote a great book a few years ago, Rise of Superman, kind of detailing flow states in extreme sports athletes.
I read that. It's a great book.
It's a great book. And just thinking about it, where it's like, you know, those flow states where it's almost like that inner critic is silenced, like, where it's just like everything is just coming out naturally. And so do you pay any attention to flow states and in terms of your writing? Or
the funny thing is that as soon as you notice you're in a flow state, it's gone.
Yes.
And so I definitely, at this point, I have enough practice in saying to my inner critic, okay, thank you, I'm just going to keep writing, that when I start my writing for the day, I have a few moments where I have to consciously say, like, no, I'm not going to delete that. I'm going to keep writing. But by the time I've done it 3 or 4 times, the inner critic just kind of quiets down. And then, like, I can write all day. And until I notice, like, oh, hey, this is going great. And then boom, all of a sudden it's gone. Because as soon as you notice you're in a flow state, that's your conscious, like, analytical mind clicking back in and, like, bam, it's gone. But yeah, I mean, it's magic. I love that flow state. And I love that book. It's a great description of the flow state.
Do you think that, because mindfulness in a way, it almost seems a bit like, I mean, it's sort of activating that part of the mind that in a flow state might be silenced. Is that the way you see it? Or, like, do you feel like, I don't know, can mindfulness it like help with flow states in writing, or do you think it's an opposite process?
It kind of depends on your aim. Let's see if I can pick this apart. So for me, finding a flow state in writing, meditation is a great way to find that flow state in writing, because the thing that most interrupts my focus and concentration is that inner critic. So using my mindfulness of thought practice to quiet the inner critic, and then it does eventually just get quiet enough that it's not in the way and I can just write. Now, if you're talking about Buddhism in a more traditional Buddhist context, like as a search for enlightenment, as a cessation of suffering, that kind of thing, I was actually just teaching a class yesterday about the Eightfold Path, and the last step of it is right concentration, and that samasati is the Pali word for right concentration, but there's also badly translated wrong concentration, which only means that you're not focused on enlightenment. So something like yoga would be considered wrong concentration, because you're focused on yoga. It doesn't mean yoga is bad. Yoga is a great thing to do. But in terms, if your goal is enlightenment, then focusing on anything other than concentration and breath and going deeper into a state of meditation would be considered wrong. It's not a great, I hate the word wrong as translation. It's not a good translation. But In that context, using meditation to write would be considered wrong, because I'm not using meditation to lessen suffering and gain my enlightenment and reincarnation into nirvana. And but as I'm not a monk and as I am a writer, this form of concentration actually works really well for me in my vocation.
And now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about just in terms of, you know, your own practice, kind of studying mindfulness with, you know, a couple of, seems like some of the most renowned mindfulness teachers, Tara Brach and Jack Kornfield. Tell me about kind of that experience studying under those experts and just what were some of the most impactful teachings?
They are such good teachers, both of them. And it's kind of funny because Tara Brach originally was a student of Jack's. I mean, Jack's been teaching for so long. And so when was it? This would have been 2018. I saw the ad, I guess on Instagram actually, and it was from Sounds True that Tara Brach and Jack Kornfield were gonna be teaching an online class. And I don't even know why I signed up at that point. It was one of those instinctive, like, I didn't know I wanted to teach meditation. I wasn't particularly drawn to teaching meditation. I think what I wanted was community around my meditation, because the group that I had been meeting with in Los Angeles had disbanded and I was sitting alone on the cushion, and that can get kind of lonely. That, like, community is actually an important part of a meditation practice. So long story short, I signed up for the class. It's wonderful. They teach it every 2 years. So if anyone is at all interested in meditation teacher training, I would highly recommend it. Very thoughtful. It's all recorded video lessons, with the exception of there was an opening retreat where we actually got to go and sit with them. And then there was supposed to be a closing retreat, but of course it was spring of 2021 and nobody was going anywhere. So, it was just this past spring. So we did like an online retreat, which is not quite the same, but it was still lovely. I've done a lot of retreats with other teachers as well. And I think it's important to keep an open mind about different teachers, to try different teachers, to not assume that the teacher who is like the most famous and wonderful is going to be the teacher who jives best for you, or speaks most closely to you. I've learned an enormous amount from Jack and Tara, but I've also found other teachers that I resonate with the same, if not more deeply with. So I count myself very lucky to have studied with them.
Now, I wanted to ask, as far as you had mentioned an interest in kind of the intersection of mindfulness and neuroscience. So tell me about that. What interests you there?
Well, I actually got my undergraduate degree in biology. I am not a scientist, but I don't know, I'm a science fan. If there was like a fandom, like Scientific American and National Geographic, I am like such a nerd for these things. And then when you overlay mindfulness, particularly the way that Jack and Tara teach it, they teach teachers a very secular form of mindfulness. So Jack has his background in like sitting in the monastery in his youth and being with the monks. But nowadays when he's teaching, it's very in line with, neuropsychology and just brain function in general. He's done a lot of work with, at UCLA.
Dr. Dan Siegel.
Dan Siegel, yeah. So Dan Siegel, I love his story because Jack Kornfield talks about mindfulness being kind of, so the search for enlightenment, Buddhism, lightening of suffering in general. He talks sometimes about how there is a path and it's a kind of akin to like, if you're in San Francisco and you want to get to Bakersfield, you go south, right? For those who live in California, you know, that's like, there's a way you can go to get from San Francisco to Bakersfield. Now, you don't have to go that way. You can go from San Francisco to Portland, you know, travel through Utah a little bit, circle down, maybe dip into Mexico, and then make your way back up to Bakersfield. And he likes to joke that that's how Dan Siegel did it. So Dan Siegel is this neuroscientist, and he started exploring all these concepts of awareness and self-awareness and how does the brain work and how does the brain become aware of itself. And when he started giving lectures, his lectures sounded so much like Jack Kornfield's that they ended up becoming really close friends because they were saying the same thing. They had just come about it at two totally different paths. And so now they actually work together quite a bit. And I love that intersection of where I love the Buddhist side of it just because I love the philosophy and the stories. But if you strip away the religious, the Buddhist part of it, and you just look at the neurology and the neuroscience behind mindfulness, you see, you can start to become aware of your own reactions to things. You can start to, like, inherited trauma, I think, is a really fascinating area of study that's really starting to open up. Just the way that our bodies and our minds carry our history, connect with other people, define our reactions to things. I forget where I was reading this. It may have been in Siegel's book, his book Aware, but he talks about how when organisms evolved, the brain actually evolves last. You know, simple organisms are just organs. And then the brain only just evolves to coordinate the action of those organs. And so when you think about the brain as simply being an organizer of what's happening in your body, you can start to disassociate from the personification with emotions. Like instead of like, I'm so sad, you can be like, oh, there's sadness. Like my heart hurts a little bit. I'm sweaty, I have tears. Like there is sadness here, but I don't have to feel as identified with it. I can get curious about it. I can feel it in its whole and I can watch it pass because everything does. And that's when you get back to that like kind of Buddhist thing of like, nothing is permanent, everything will pass. I love it. I love that intersection of the neuroscience and the Buddhism coming together in modern mindfulness.
Do you think that they're always synergistic, or is there anything specifically like in Buddhist teaching that contradicts what neuroscience is saying about mindfulness or meditation, or vice versa? Or are they pretty aligned?
I mean, it depends on how you're defining mindfulness in relationship to Buddhism. When you're deep into the Buddhist texts, I mean, you're talking about reincarnation, you're talking about like all kinds of stuff that, I don't know, modern science might take issue with. I haven't really explored that, but I would assume that reincarnation is not considered a legitimate course of study at UCLA. So I think there are probably are areas where they don't overlap, and in the Venn diagram of it, there is an interesting amount of overlap.
Got it. Okay. Now, switching gears a little bit, I want to hear about your novel. So 142 Ostriches. First, yes. Tell me about the title.
Here's the cover. The title, it's a story about a young woman who inherits her grandmother's ostrich farm in the Mojave Desert, and her first inclination is to sell it. But then the middle generation that's been skipped over for the inheritance, they all come to the farm for the funeral, and you know, all the skeletons come out of the closet, and it's really much more about the family than the ostriches. But I loved the setting of an ostrich farm for a family story because they're kind of weird, and I think families can be kind of weird, and every family is weird in its own way, And that just seemed like a good setting.
And then were there any specific things that inspired the story? Is it, how did you sort of come up with the idea?
Yeah, well, when I originally started writing it, it was very much based on my mom's upbringing. Her grandfather took her to live on the family farm when she was 13, because my mom's mom was not doing a great job raising her. But the farm was a dairy farm. And so as I started to write the stories, I didn't really want to write a dairy farm, because first of all, I don't know much about dairy farms. And there are enough people in the world who do that, you know, I knew I would have to get it right, and felt like a lot of pressure. And I'm not particularly drawn to dairy farms. I love the desert. I really wanted to set a story in the desert. So I was trying to see, you know, how could I do a farm in the desert? And I was Googling and came across this ostrich ranch. And I went out and did a tour with the guy who owned it. And he was really nice and really generous with his time. We ended up just walking around. I thought I'd do a quick tour and then he'd like boot me because he'd be busy. But I think he was kind of lonely, and it was just him on the farm out in the middle of the desert with all these birds. So we ended up talking for hours. And by the time I left, I was like, yeah, this is great. And he gave me so many little details about life on the farm, the dealing with the birds, you know, his trials of learning to deal with the birds, because he had been an investment banker when he decided to be an ostrich rancher. So it was a very steep learning curve, which full of good stories. And yeah, I went back out there a few times to get some details from him. And as I rewrote it, it became less and less my mom's story and more just an invented story based on the anecdotes that he told me about living on the ostrich farm. And then of course, a lot of stuff I just made up because it's fiction. But yeah, that's how it came to be.
And what are some of the main like themes of the book?
It's a lot about mothers and daughters, which, I mean, these are really tough women. They live tough lives, but the main character's mother more or less abandoned her when she was 13, which is why she was on the farm. Grandma was always very distant. And so Tallulah, my main character, has this idea of like, she's going to go do her own thing. She's taken off. And then when everything goes down around the farm, she has to really decide whether she's going to stay on the ranch and like be a part of this family, or book it and just do her own thing like everyone in her family does. And what she comes to learn throughout the story is that there's real value in being part of a family, that it's hard, that people can be awful to each other sometimes, even when they love each other, but that it's worth hanging in there. That's the overall theme of the book.
Interesting. Okay. So rather than take off and choose maybe the easier route, to kind of stick with it and be part of that family.
Yeah. But I also am like a big fan of plot. So like there's blood. It's like, I like when it's like big things happen in stories. So I don't want to give the impression that's like a quiet family story. There's actually quite a bit of dramatic things that happen. There's addiction and bloody fights, and things get ugly.
Juicy, right? Yeah. On. Do you have ideas for, are there books in the future that you're planning on writing?
Yes. This one is almost done. Check it out.
Oh my gosh.
It's almost done. I actually thought it was done, and then my husband read it for me and he had this really great idea for the middle chapter. So I had to pull apart the middle chapter, but I've almost finished rewriting that. And then I'm going to do one more pass and then it's off to the editor. It's almost done.
Awesome. What yeah. is that one about?
This one,
able to talk about it.
Yeah. I wouldn't have earlier, but it's so close to done. I feel like I've got a handle on it now. The basic one-liner is that it follows two characters who, they're a couple, and they find themselves in the unusual position of being immortal until they decide to have a baby. So it starts in the 1700s, and it follows their adventures like around the world and through 250 years. And then the last chapter takes place modern day in Los Angeles.
Interesting. So they're yeah. able to be immortal, but then once they have the child,
that would break
immortality
it.
Is okay. So then they're kind of plagued by the decision of whether to have that child or not.
I mean, that was what inspired the story, is that like, why does anyone ever have a child? Right. And the immortality of youth that people talk about, I just took that and made it real. And she, the main, the the male characters, like, why would we ever give this up? This is amazing. We're going to do this forever. Life is great. We're young. And she wants a family. And it's not just about the baby. It's about like having community, because they can't stay in one place more than a couple of years. She's always having to remember a different backstory. And she's like, I'm tired of this. I don't want to do it anymore. So it's this conflict between them that gets increasingly dramatic as time goes on. And then the circumstances of their lives and how those influence the things. Like, it actually, modern day, it's very hard to reinvent yourself every 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Versus like the 1700s when you could just move to the next town over and no one would know who you were. No big deal. I don't know. It's been really fun to write it. It's been a really challenging story, to find through lines through, like, over 250 years. You know, how do you have a villain when you have characters who are immortal? How do you, yeah, I found one. How do you, like, the love interest, they are a couple, but they're together for so long that there are points where their relationship is challenged. Do you still love someone after you've lived with them for 250 years? Can you? I mean, these were questions that I was excited to explore. So it's been a fun one to write.
Now, in terms of your writing process, I mean, do you like, or just generating ideas, do you find like mindfulness or just like your meditation practice? Do you get a lot of ideas for your writing or things that you want to switch around or
It's a good question. I would say more often not. Now and then, like if I'm struggling with a story point and I'm meditating, sometimes something will come to me, but that's very rare. And when it does happen, I'll stop meditating and write it down because, yeah, because that's a gift and I don't want to let it go. I mean, again, the wise thing, the like going towards enlightenment thing would be to like let it go. But I don't know, if I've been struggling for a story point and it comes to me, I totally stop and write it down.
Sure. All right. Well, April, it was great having you on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Do you have any kind of any closing thoughts before we wrap up? Anything related to mindfulness or writing?
Well, I guess I would put out there that if anyone's interested in mindfulness and writing, we have this group. It's me and four other teachers called A Very Important Meeting. And we're at averyimportantmeeting.com. You can look it up. It's also on my website, aprildavila.com. You'll find links to it. But it's great. I love it. It's such a fun group of people. We're up to 18 meetings. It's a week now where you log on. We meditate for a few minutes just to quiet our minds. And then we write in silence for 45 minutes, which it always seems a little strange. It's like, why would I need to log on to write? But there's something very communal about looking up and seeing on the little Zoom squares, all these other writers working hard at their craft. And then when we end the hour, we just chat a little bit. There's no pressure to, nobody shares their work. We don't read, we don't offer prompts. So there's no pressure to like, is your writing good enough, right? Because no one's gonna know, you don't have to share it. We have people who come just to write in their journals. We have people who are like New York Times columnists. Like, we have a full gamut of writers who come. So if anyone's curious about doing some writing that involves mindfulness, it's an all or welcome situation. We do a donation-based payment scheme, so it's a very low pressure. Like, if you can give $5, it's appreciated, but all are welcome. So I would definitely throw that out there if anyone is interested in checking that out. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess the next level of that would be my 6-week Mindful Writer Challenge. I'm going to launch the next one in February and applications will open in January. So if people have either a writing practice or a meditation practice and want to go deeper, they can check out my website for the application starting in January. Or if you go now, there's like a little link where you can get on a list that I'll let you know when the application opens if someone's interested in that. And other than that, maybe picking up my book and giving it a read.
Great. Yeah.
Those would be my main pitches.
Yeah. I recommend you guys go check that out. And for the listeners who enjoyed the show, go ahead and like and subscribe to our YouTube channel where Ross Goes Wetsuit Neuro. You can find the full podcast episodes on that channel along with podcast clips posted every day. Also, go ahead and subscribe on whatever audio platform that you listen to the podcast on, whether that be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or any of the other ones. We are on them all. April, I wanted to really thank you again for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed our discussion.
Thanks again for having me. It was good talking.
Welcome to Toby's Takeaways, where I break down some of the three most important takeaways from the interview that you just listened to with April Davila. First takeaway is that mindfulness can make us more aware of behavioral patterns in our lives that are unhealthy, enabling us to handle them in better ways. In April's case, she became more aware of the negative impact drinking alcohol had on her life when she began practicing mindfulness seriously. Next takeaway is that achieving success with mindfulness training is more likely if you find a teacher that you really connect with, and it might be more important than necessarily finding an uber popular or even famous teacher. April said that she learned more from teachers who may have been more low key, but that she really connected with. And the third takeaway is that mindfulness can really help writers fight the inner critic and keep it at bay in order to successfully write and get their thoughts onto the page.